Thanks, Alan. I don't know who you were talking about, but I hope I get to hear them share. I don't know. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Derek. How is everyone doing tonight?
Great.
Five of us are doing great. Okay. How's the rest of everyone doing?
Great.
After the baseball game. All right. Cool. I'm competing with a lot here. We got a lot. Go Stros. I'm from Chicago originally, so I don't have a whole heck of a lot invested in the game, in the sports ball that's going on. So, can you all hear me okay? Yeah? All right. So, when I'm asked to tell my story, you know, what's really interesting is that I don't spend a whole heck of a lot of time on what it was like. I think we all know what it was like. Mostly because, in terms of my story, I don't remember most of it, and the rest of it I just kind of make up as I go along. But there are a couple of pertinent facts that I would like to share about me and about sort of my background and what brings me here. The first is, well, when I call these facts, really I refer to these as strikes. I had three strikes working against me when I first got sober. And I call them strikes because, statistically speaking, any one of these three things have proven to be an obstacle for recovery for people in the past. And I had all three of them. The first being that I got sober young. I got sober at the age of 20. So I'm part of the Never Had a Legal Drink Club. I'm just curious, is anyone else part of that club currently in here? Cool. All right. I got one. It's a big number, but it's a small percentage. I mean, there are quite a few people in that club. But for whatever reason, we don't see a lot of people begin a process of lifelong recovery before their 21st birthday. And I don't know why that is. We might see someone come in, get a year or something, plant some few seeds. But really, that process of lifelong recovery, we don't see starting usually then. The other strike I had working against me was that I was court-ordered to attend treatment. I did not initiate a process of recovery myself. A process of recovery was initiated for me. I'm part of the Nudge from the Judge Club. Anyone else in here part of that club currently? Yeah? You came in from someone else thought it was a good idea that you get sober. Those aren't the most ripe conditions either to begin a process of lifelong recovery. I mean, they're just not. I shouldn't be here just based on that alone. And then the third strike I had working against me was that it was my first exposure to this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps. I'd never really heard of the 12 Steps before going to treatment, so I've been sober since my very first meeting ever. So I'm a one-hit wonder. That's what they call that, right? I'm in that club. Anyone else in that club? There's a couple of us. Sober since the very first meeting. So, you know, I don't share that information to impress anyone. I don't consider that information to be impressive. In order for me to think that information is impressive, I'd have to think that there's something special about me, and I don't. I'm just a run-of-the-mill drunk. There is something special about what's in this book. But I share that information because if by any chance someone is in this room and thinking to themselves that there's some reason they can't recover, maybe you're thinking that. You have some reason in your mind why it won't be able to work for you. I feel confident based on my experience that without even knowing you, without even knowing what that might be, that worst case scenario, it's a challenge. You might have a challenge on your hands, might have some circumstance where you have to roll up your sleeves and do some extra work. But I don't believe in roadblocks. There might be some hurdles, but I don't think that you have anything that's going to actually block you. If I can recover, anyone can recover. And I mean that. I truly believe that. Toward the end of my drinking, my life had become... Can you all still hear me? I find if I stand like right here, I get less feedback in my ears, but you can hear me okay?
No?
No? So I have to hear an echo. I have to hear an echo. I have to. That's okay. I was talking before the meeting that I really like the sound of my own voice. So it's fortunate that I get to listen to myself talk tonight. So toward the end of my drinking, I found that my life had become divided into one of four activities. Regardless of anything else that I was doing at the moment, I was always doing one of these four things, no matter what else it ever looked like I was doing. At any given moment, I was always either trying to drink, drinking, recuperating from drinking, or trying not to drink. It was always one of those four things. I was either trying to drink, drinking, recuperating from drinking, or trying not to drink. And for a while, that was, you know, just my life. It wasn't cyclical. It didn't always go in order. Sometimes I bounced between one and two for a while. Sometimes I bounced between three and four. But I always sort of had this idea that if I was ever going to get freedom, if I was ever going to overcome alcoholism, that it would require sort of hitting some sort of imaginary pain threshold. Something would have to happen. And that event would be so painful, it would snap me out of it, and I would suddenly just magically overnight become an expert at number four. I'd become really good at trying not to drink. And I thought that's what they were going to teach me in treatment, and I thought that's what they were going to teach me in the rooms. Nobody's taught me how to be good at trying not to drink. Fortunately, I haven't tried to not drink in almost two decades. And I don't say that because I'm cocky. I say that because I'm not afraid. You know, I think probably the only thing that a recovered alcoholic and a non-alcoholic have in common is that neither one of them are trying not to drink. The only people on the planet who try to not drink are untreated alcoholics. They talk in this book about meeting all sorts of conditions, having alcohol in our homes, having friends who drink, going to see moving pictures that show drinking scenes. Yeah, moving pictures. Yeah, got to spin those pictures really fast, and they show drinking scenes. And then they say something really interesting. They say, we meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet these conditions still has an alcoholic mind. Now, I'm not saying that there's something wrong with those situations feeling threatening. What I'm saying is we literally have in the palm of our hands an instruction manual written by a group of people making the claim that those situations aren't threatening for them, and that they've figured out how you can tap into that and to have that be your experience too. So it seems to me an excellent question, why would I settle for anything less if that's available for me? I mean, certainly if it's not available for me, then, you know, some of the stuff that you might hear, like stay away from people, places, and things, you know, avoid temptation, you know, all that other stuff. How many of y'all have heard that? Stay away from people, places, and things. Have y'all also heard don't make any major changes? Can you tell me how I'm supposed to do both of those? How am I supposed to do both of those? I haven't figured that out. Right? To thine own self be true? Or fake it till you make it? How am I supposed to do both of those? Stick with the winners, but you know, don't take other people's inventory. You know, I used to work third shift at a gas station. And anyone ever work third shift in a gas station? One person, all right. Well, I got a connection with someone here. You know that not everyone coming into the gas station at 2 in the morning is there to buy gas. There's some shady characters. And I remember that people would walk into the gas station and walk right up the counter if they were lost. They'd walk right past the rack of maps. See, kids, back in my day, we had these things called maps. Think GPS, but on paper. And large sheets of paper. And they would walk right past the rack of maps. They'd walk up to me and they'd say, "Where is such and such?" And the truth is, if I didn't know where they were going, I would make something up. And I would try to make sure it was as far away as possible. But if they did happen to make it back and make their way up to the counter to ask me for another round of directions, they would make sure to grab a map first and spread it out across the counter while they're having the conversation with me. And in recovery, our meetings are the gas station, your sponsor is the attendant, and the book is the map. Nobody can read your book for you, and it's not your job to take someone's word for it, what it says. You have to make sure you know what it says. Because unfortunately, we exist in a culture, a recovery culture, where if someone doesn't quite know what it's going to take for you to get well, they're probably going to make something up. And it won't be as nefarious as it was when I was making up directions. This will be well-intentioned people who will come up with something that sounds right or feels right, and they'll offer it to you, and that's when you get a lot of conflicting information like what I was just talking about. So when I got sober at the age of 20 and I'm in treatment and I'm in there with people that are twice my age and I'm in there in some cases with people that are three times my age and we get together in these little groups and we talk about this thing called alcoholism, we often talked about it in terms of loss. And don't get me wrong, there were people in there that had lost an awful lot. There were cats in there that had lost jobs, careers, houses, businesses, family members, health. I was 20 years old, man. I'd lost a couple of CDs and a pair of shoes. If diagnosing myself as alcoholic required me to conjure up a laundry list of consequences as a result of my drinking, I wouldn't be able to measure up. And fortunately, that's not the diagnosis, right? It's not about what happened to me externally. The diagnosis is entirely internal. See, the first step for me is not about, are you having problems in your life as a result of excessive drinking? It's not even, are you excessively drinking? The first step is, are you making choices? I don't care how much you drink. The Big Book authors didn't care how much you drank. On 33, they say something about, and I'm paraphrasing here, but in order to be gravely affected, in other words, real alcoholic, one does not have to take the quantities that we did, nor drink for the length of time that we did. You don't have to have the same amount and duration of drinking that I did in order to diagnose yourself as alcoholic. In fact, you could be drinking quite as much as I was, and if you're drinking that amount by choice, well, there's not a problem. See, I wasn't drinking what I was drinking by choice, right? But I didn't realize that, because early on, when you're 20 years old and you get your hands on alcohol, the goal is to get drunk. That's the goal. And if every time you drink, the goal is to get drunk, and you do in fact get drunk, then in a strange way, you're controlling your drinking. I have no reason to try to control or limit the amount that I take, but I need to have evidence of that. In order to diagnose myself, I needed to be able to find examples in my life where I was drinking and using amounts larger than what I had set out to do, amounts larger than what I had wanted to do. That's where the diagnosis comes from. And so that's what I have to be looking at. And then I've worked with a lot of guys over the years, and people often try to skip this price of entry. That's the price of entry. You don't get to say, well, I wasn't that type of alcoholic. Right? No, I'm the type of alcoholic that's not making choices. If you just drank a lot, you don't need us. If you drank a lot against your will, you do. I struggle with the higher power thing. I was a practicing Satanist when I got sober. Any other practicing Satanists in the room? No? I always stand alone. Stop it. If I said if anyone else is speaking tonight, you'd raise your hand too, I bet. So I had some issues with God. I didn't like the idea of God. I didn't like the word God. My first big book looked like a declassified government document. I'd gone through with a black marker and crossed out every time it said God or prayer or anything like that. I just didn't like it. And I had some real struggles. And one of the things I like to tell people that was shared with me early on is, yes, we're talking about God. That's the bad news. We're not talking about a doorknob. We're not talking about a process of selection, right? I don't care what you call your higher power. What I care about is that you realize you're talking about the same higher power that I call God. And one of us is closer to the truth on that than the other, but we're not talking about 1,000 different versions of this thing. There's one thing that kind of runs the whole deal here, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that thing. But we are also talking about willingness. And willingness is an interesting word. You know, willingness does not mean I'm on the edge of my seat and I'm hoping to find out that I've been wrong about God this whole time. That's not what that means. Willingness, how many of y'all have ever had a friend that's moved and asked you to help them move? Okay. Yeah. Y'all are a bunch of liars. Nobody trusts you enough to help them move. So my buddy asked me to help him move on a Friday. You know, hey, can you come help us tomorrow? Yeah, okay. But Friday night, I'm hoping it rains tomorrow. Because I really don't want to go. But I'm willing. Right? I'm willing. If I wake up tomorrow and the weather's nice, I guess I'll put on my shoes and I'll get there. I might even be a half hour late. But I'm willing. That's all willingness is. That's all we're talking about. You know, we're talking about if what you currently believe about the universe were wrong, would you want to know? I mean, that's my reason for not believing in God in the first place, right? Is it's just not true. I'm just committed to truth. And I used to say things like, if you showed me enough evidence for God, I would believe. And I used to think that that was the hallmark of open-mindedness. But then somebody asked me, Derek, what would be enough evidence? Well, it turns out enough evidence was whatever you had and then some. You know, I wasn't really interested in truth. I was interested in feeling good. And so my sponsor asked me that question. If what you currently believe were wrong, would you want to know? Now, the truth is, there were a time in my life, maybe about a month before that question was asked to me, where the answer would have been no. I'm not interested in any sort of journey. I'm not interested in anything that might change my mind. I'm not interested in arriving at any new truth. I don't care what you have to show me. You know, atheism is my identity. This is who I am. But I was just in the right place at the right time when he asked me that. And I was at a point where I said, you know what, yeah. If I've been wrong about God this whole time, I'd want to know that. I would genuinely want to know that. I wouldn't take it personal. I didn't invent atheism. I don't need to defend it. It's not my idea. Right? So I would want to know that. He said, great, you're ready to make a decision. That decision is step 3, by the way. And when faced with that decision, he made it very clear that you've just become willing to seek power, and now you're going to make a decision to seek power. You know, that word decide is really interesting. Right? D-E-C-I-D-E. We don't use that word appropriately today. The doctor warns us of this. In the doctor's opinion, he talks about alcoholics and he says, they make many resolutions but never a decision. You think he's warning us about something? No, he's warning us. I've made many resolutions to stop drinking. I never made a decision to change my life. Today we use the word decide to talk about something that really resembles more of preference. Like, oh, I decided to get in shape. Oh, really? What gym did you sign up with? Well, I haven't yet. Oh, but you're looking at gyms. Where are you looking? No, I haven't started looking yet. Oh, but I mean, you have a nice pair of gym clothes? No. Do you have a pair of gym shoes? No. Do you even know someone named Jim? No. That's not a decision. Right? If you look at D-E-C-I-D-E, the last four letters of that are C-I-D-E. If you look at just about every other word that ends in C-I-D-E, homicide, suicide, pesticide, genocide, insecticide, patricide, what they all have in common is something dies. And to decide is to kill all other options. See, I've heard someone say that step one is I can't, step two is he can, and step three is let him. That's cute and it's trite and it's easy to remember, and that's probably why it's so popular. But I think step one is I will die for alcohol. There's no hope in step one. I don't know where this nonsense that the principle of step one is honesty came from. The principle of step one is hopelessness. You ought to feel hopeless. Part of the problem we have today is that nobody walks in the door with a diagnosis of hopeless. When was the last time a doctor diagnosed an alcoholic as hopeless? They haven't. And the reason for that is we have a lot of success with the 12 steps. We've undermined one of the greatest allies that we've had in this deal, which is people understanding that they're hopeless walking in the door. Today there's a lot of confusion about that. I try to sit down and describe step one to someone today, and they get all jammed up and they immediately jump to step two. They say, well, wait, this is without God what you're describing, right? Hold on, let's sit with the discomfort of hopelessness for a moment, shall we? That's where you need to be. And how it works, it tells me the more hopeless he feels, the better. Well, all right then. You need to feel a little hopeless for this thing to be effective. So step one is I will die for alcohol. We can have a conversation if you disagree with that. You can show me what you got. But when I read that step in the book, when I read that step in the 12 and 12, I don't arrive at any other conclusion. That's the message of step one. I will die for alcohol. Step two gives me a little bit of hope by giving me an alternative. I will live for God or I will die for alcohol. There's a choice there. I don't like that choice, but there's a choice. I'll live for God or I'll die for alcohol. By the way, if you believe, live for God means live to serve God. If you don't believe, live for God means live to find God. But either way, it's live for God or die for alcohol. And then step three, the power of step three, ironically, is that it eliminates one of the choices. Step three is I will live for God or die trying. I'll live for God or die trying. We all understand this concept. We've all played poker at some point, right? When you go all in on a hand, that's it. It's this hand. It's this hand or else. This is it. I'm going to do this or I'm going to die. I'm not going to do this, get halfway through, and think something else is going to work. You know, how do I come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity? Process of elimination. I've tried everything else. I've tried everything else. Nothing else works. So once I made that decision, I made a list. People I'm mad at, things I'm scared of, people I've hurt. We call that list a fourth step. Searching and fearless moral inventory. It's a lot like a root canal. It's more scary than it is painful. But nobody's died of a four-step. Nobody's died of a four-step. You know, I think sometimes we take the steps, we put them on the wall, we don't look at what the book's really saying about them because, you know, I sit down to write this four-step and I get all wrapped up in shame. Anyone else relate to that? A lot of shame. You ever stop to think about where that comes from, though? You know, one of the prerequisites for even writing inventory, it says so right in the book. Page 60, the first requirement. There's a requirement. The first requirement. What comes before the first requirement? Nothing. The first requirement is that we become convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. How do you think I'm going to do that? How do you think I become convinced of that? I've got to write down in black and white the results of my life running on self-will. That's what an inventory is. It's all the stuff that comes about as a result of me living my life on self-will. I've got written evidence that my third step decision was the most brilliant decision I've ever made. Well, how often do you get that? You buy a house, you buy a car. Even if you think it's a good idea, still 10 years later, you don't get written evidence of it from anyone. The bank doesn't show up and say, look, here, brilliant decision. The fourth step is my written evidence that my third step decision was a brilliant decision. The only thing that hurts about the stuff that I'm writing down is the residual from the belief that I ought to see something here that I like. I ought to see something. This is just me living on self-will, for crying out loud. There ought to be something redeemable about it. No. You're just seeing it for the first time. You know, if you'd never seen a fish before in your entire life, you all have seen a fish before, right? All right. No hands went up for that. That's weird. We've all seen a fish before. If you'd never seen a fish before in your entire life, and the very first time I introduced you to a fish, it was one of those big old koi pond fish. But it was like just in the middle of a pile of gravel. No water. You would see that thing, and you would say, what a mistake. What kind of a loving God makes a creature like this? It's flopping around. It looks like it's convulsing in seizures. It looks like it's suffocating. It's got no appendages. It can't manipulate itself. It looks like it's got about a life expectancy of about a half an hour. This is clearly a mistake, this ugly creature. Because you're seeing it where it doesn't belong. You're seeing it in an environment where it's not meant to thrive. But in a fourth step, I'm taking a look at my life for the very first time. I'm meeting myself for the very first time. And where am I meeting myself? Outside of where I belong. The spiritual equivalent of a pile of gravel. I'm seeing myself running outside the sunlight of the Spirit, where humans are not designed to live. Fish aren't designed to live outside of water. Plants aren't designed to live outside of sunlight. Humans aren't designed to live outside of God's will. That's a statement about what it means to be human. When they write that in the book, they're not talking about alcoholics. They're making a statement about what it means to be human. No person can be a success running on self-will. Any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Now I've got written evidence of it. The only thing that hurts about looking at that list is my denial of that truth. So if you're writing inventory and you get all jammed up about it, and you're like, man, this sucks, go back to that third step decision. Do you really understand what they're saying about what it means to be human? You're not going to see anything successful. You run your life through a simulation 1,000 times, with the only criteria being that you run on self-will. Yeah, you might see different stuff on the fourth step, but you're never going to see one that has anything that you like. It's always going to end up with something you dislike. It's always going to end up looking ugly. That's the result of running on self-will. You didn't just have a bad run as a result of a few bad decisions. You're trying to operate a car on motor oil instead of gasoline, right? It's just not going to run well. So after I make that list, I share it with someone in 5. There's not a whole lot to say about that other than it felt like a genuine rite of passage. It felt like a genuine rite of passage. You know, I came out of that fifth step and I had finally done the deal. I no longer felt like I was an observer on the outside of this thing looking in, but that I'd finally had some experience. In fact, one of the promises in step 5 is that we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. I walked into step 5 with a set of spiritual beliefs. God doesn't exist. If he does exist, he won't help. If he does help, it won't work. If it does work, it won't stick. If it does stick, I won't want it. We don't typically think of those as being spiritual beliefs, but that was the extent of Derek Stone's spirituality walking into my fifth step. I had those beliefs walking into a fifth step. Now, at the end of my fifth step, I still had those beliefs. But I began to have an experience that contradicted those beliefs. And I read somewhere that a man with an experience is not at the mercy of a man with an opinion. And prior to that moment in my life, all I had ever been was a man of opinion. I had certain beliefs about the world, but that just boiled down to how I wanted the world to work. But at the end of the fifth step, I started having an experience that showed me something else could be true. I believe they call that an existential crisis. And if you ever have the opportunity to have one, I highly recommend it. It's the coolest kind of crisis you can have. Part of the problem we have in this deal is we have a lot of people with experience trying to help people that have a lot of theories. You know, and it says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And so I'm living something that's experiential in nature, attempting to help someone that's just looking at it from the outside with a lot of theories about how it's not going to work. You're not the guinea pig. I'm not saying, hey, try patience and tolerance and see if that works. Let me know. If it works, I'll give it a try too. I'm talking to you from experience. Right? The book is talking to us from experience. When it says, hey, stop having fear-based reactions to things and trust. You actually don't have to make decisions. You don't have to run stuff. Yeah, looking at that from the outside, looking in, that's going to seem like I've got a lot of theories as to what could go wrong with that. Yeah, but I've got a lot of experience as to what can go right with that. So anyway, at the end of that fifth step, I became ready to let God make me a better person. Right? That's step six. Entirely ready. To me, that's just a result of working the first five steps. If I've worked the first five steps effectively, I become entirely ready. And so step seven is a process of asking him to. Now, I will admit that step's grown a little bit deeper for me over the years. In the very beginning, my first seventh step was actually like some weird satanic ritual that I did to remove defects of character. If you can imagine something more ridiculous than that, please tell me, because that's about the most ridiculous thing I can imagine. But having gone through the work a little bit more and examining a little bit deeper over the years, that seven-step prayer is really deep. There's a lot in there. You know, the idea that God needs all of me, good and bad, that God's going to remove from me defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness. You know, if I had it my way, step seven would be about me being struck perfect, but it's not. It's about me being useful exactly the way I am, getting over myself and going out and helping another person, despite the fact that I don't quite have all the answers or I don't know the book well, all the objections I hear from people. Eight's a list. I was having a conversation with a friend the other day about eighth step and how it's such a weird step, you know, because it's like we already have the list at the end of four and we're already willing to make those amends. So what's the point of having an eighth step? For me, the value is that it's a finite list. I haven't just hurt everybody that I've ever come into contact with. Nine, I'm not going to say a whole lot about nine. I'm at the point in my recovery where I've made more amends for harms I've caused in sobriety than for harms I caused when I was drinking. And if you're clinging to the idea that these steps are going to bring you to a place where you're forever beyond reproach and you'll never cause harm in sobriety, let me just dispel that for you, right? Because you will have to develop a willingness to make amends for stuff moving forward. It's not like, oh, I'm going to do these 12 steps and be beyond reproach and now I'll never have to apologize for anybody ever again. And you'll find yourself justifying really quick with that mindset. 10, 11, and 12 is where I live today. That's the foundation of my program, right? It's where I live today. 10 encompasses everything we've done in the first nine steps. 11 and 12 incorporate prayer and meditation and service. That's where I live. And that's quite a great place to live. I'm really pleased to be living there. Working with others is the foundation of my life. It's the absolute foundation. I've got like a stark raving fan here. That's what it is. You know, this is the first time I've spoken since this beard has been this long. This beard has never been longer than it is today. I've been working on it the whole time I've had it. You know, I'll just say about sponsorship, and I could talk more about 10-11. I don't have a lot of time, and I try to be respectful of time whenever I speak, but I'll say about 12, early on in my recovery, you know, I asked a handful of people to be my sponsor, maybe four or five people, and they all said no. I don't know why they said no. I don't know if they missed that part in the book that says that working with others is the bright spot of our lives or what. Maybe they weren't in a good place. Maybe they were a serial killer and I wasn't their type. I don't know. But I made a promise to myself based on that experience that I would never do that to anybody. That I would never say no. That if someone said, well, I didn't think it would ever happen, but if somebody said, hey, Derek, would you be my sponsor? That I would never say no to that question because I knew how terrible it felt. Now, you know, thankfully early on I found a lot of creative ways not to say yes without saying no. I had a men's group that I was attending and there was about 100 years of sobriety in that room. And the first three or four people that asked me to sponsor them, I'd say, well, you know, why don't you come with me to my group? There's about 100 years of sobriety in there. If you don't find someone else you like better in that room, then I'll still work with you. And I got out of the first three or four people that way until the one guy that came up afterward and said, no, I'd still like to work with you. And I'm like, oh, man. And I didn't always know what I was doing. You know, even to this day, I don't always feel like, you know, I'm a lot more comfortable with not knowing. But I don't always have the sense of, like, I know exactly what I should say. I know exactly how to answer this question. I know exactly what this person needs. There's this figure of speech that people will often say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. But I believe the opposite of that is true too. When the teacher is ready, the student will appear. And when someone asks you, will you be my sponsor? Like something you have is something they need. Like we either trust God in this deal or we don't. And I have to believe that this person needs exactly what I'm prepared to give them. And that might not be a full run from 1 through 12. They might only be hanging out for the first three steps. And that's what I need to practice sharing with someone for the moment. So it's symbiotic. Abraham Lincoln once said, if I had 8 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend 6 sharpening my axe. And I never know if the person who's in front of me is me chopping down the tree, knocking it out of the park, they're going 1 through 12 and living the sober life, or just me sharpening my axe, getting better, practicing for the next person. It's not my job to know. You know, it's not my job to know. And so, you know, I work with others today and it's a bright spot of my life. It truly is. It's the greatest thing. I love working with alcoholics. I love taking guys through the steps. I love showing them the message. I love watching that transformation from darkness to light. It truly is my purpose. You know, AA has given me 3 things that I'll never be able to pay back, and I'll say this and I'll shut up. The first is it awakened me to my purpose. On page 77, the book says, my real purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people around me. I never knew I had a purpose, let alone what it is. I mean, honestly, it could have just said, kid, you have a purpose, go figure it out. And that would have been like an eye-opener, like, really? By the way, it didn't give me a purpose. That wasn't my purpose because Bill decided to write it down in a book 100 years ago. That wasn't always my purpose. He just observed it. My purpose doesn't come from man. So it awakened me to my purpose and it told me what it was. And that alone would have been enough for me to never be able to pay it back. Derek, your purpose, you know what it is? To fit yourself to be a maximum service to God and the people around you. Now go figure that out. Wow. I could live 1,000 lifetimes and never be able to pay that back. But then it goes a step further and it gives me a step-by-step set of directions whereby I can actually become the type of person who's carrying that out. Because I don't walk in the door that way. I'm not capable of working with alcoholics walking in the door. I need to undergo a process of change. I could live 1,000 lifetimes and never pay that back. But then it goes a step further and it creates this worldwide fellowship any city, any night of the week, 5 to 30 people sitting in a room in a public directory that I can look up and go attend, and any one of those people is a person with whom I can attempt to serve that purpose. You know, I don't have to cold call hospitals. I don't have to cold call churches. I don't have to go to hospitals and asylums. Like, boom, meetings. Anyone there, I have the potential to help. Like, how on earth do I ever pay that back? Like, there's just no way. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm grateful all of you are here. And with that, I'll say good night. Thank you. All right.